if we're talking about crisis, it usually invokes some sort of notion of emergency, something that has built up and reached a climax, something that might actually usher in change. But in any case, it often has the meaning that it will be over, and we'll have a period after that. So right now, for instance, in Germany, myself and a lot of colleagues we work with, they're always talking about after the crisis. You know, Germany got 1.2 million refugees just in the past 15 months or something like that, and they're always talking about, well, after the crisis, it will be like this. Or we need to set up measures for after the crisis. So also by way of definitions, well, what do you mean by refugee? Because the basic definition used in most policy and law, and maybe Gabriella will come onto this as a lawyer, is based on the 1951 UN Convention on Refugees. And that specifically points to people who are personally fearing persecution for their politics, for their ethnicity, for their practices, for their sexuality, whatever it is. So you have to have a personal fear of persecution. But then a lot of people say, well, in the tremendous number of people moving around the world today, that doesn't quite fit them. People fleeing Syria, an awful civil war. When it comes to court, when they're searching for their refugee status in Sweden or Germany or someplace, there's a danger that say, well, you are not personally in danger. You're just fleeing from a conflict. And so right away, these definitions start to get in the way. There's a lot of international discourse on should we change the definition from the 1951 Refugee Convention. And a lot of international lawyers are saying, no, we don't want to change it because we might end up with something worse and something that limits the refugee status even more. Also, in the nomenclature of refugee crisis, it's often, at least in Europe, often not called a refugee crisis, but a migrant crisis or a migration crisis. You know, so I'm thinking, well, this kind of opens it up because we're talking not about just a movement of people fleeing conflict and violence and human rights abuse, but a lot of people fleeing just horrible conditions, political, economic, environmental, and so forth. So should we be talking about a migration crisis, not a refugee crisis? And just a kind of fun fact, a lot of people seriously object to that as well. Last year, thousands of people sent in a petition to the BBC saying, stop calling it a migration crisis, because you're mixing up all sorts of levels and types of migration. One of the biggest tropes is the kind of good refugee and the undeserving economic migrant. And I'll get to that later, saying that bifurcation, which seems simple, is completely misleading as well. But you see what I mean? Just how we're talking about it starts to filter your understanding. Deserving refugee, they're fleeing persecution. Economic migrant, they really don't deserve to come in. The next kind of usage of term, and especially in the UK, a lot of people talk about what we're saying, refugee crisis, but they talk about it in terms of a humanitarian crisis. And this is especially the meaning and the discourse used, rightly I would say, by a lot of NGOs for fundraising purposes, for enacting measures in different sorts of countries. We're facing a humanitarian crisis. People are suffering on their journey away from Afghanistan or Syria or Sudan. People are dying in the oceans. Last year, something like 5,000 people died in the Mediterranean on their journeys. So couching it as a humanitarian crisis, you see what I mean? Again, shifts the way we think about people and the causes of migration and how we should react. Now, typically, as I say, that's the discourse used by NGOs and Médecins Sans Frontières and agencies that are out there to help. You don't find politicians liking to talk about humanitarian crisis. For a lot of countries, and especially, you know, European countries, where it's prompted a political crisis. What do we do about this? Involved in that, a political crisis, is a crisis of borders. What do we do about our borders? And you see Hungary erecting barbed wire fences, other places just ushering people across the border, Macedonia trying to get people up to Croatia as soon as possible and not try to touch ground. It's a crisis of borders, a crisis of politics, and of course, a crisis of the EU. Because a lot of people are saying, you know, the EU should be fixing this, not just rely on Germany or rely on Sweden or whoever. The same set of phenomena are prompting different discourses, different understanding of what the crisis is actually all about. And that leads to, of course, different measures for how we fix it. I'm just saying that, you know, right now we're talking about global refugee crisis, this emergency, this buildup, mainly because of this flood of people into Europe. And, Gabrielle will talk about Australia as well. You know, maybe that's a good thing because it's turning attention to these multiple meanings of crisis. But in a lot of ways, it's a shame because really, you know, if we want to talk about a refugee crisis or a crisis of movement of displaced peoples, 70% of the world's refugees or displaced people are in the Middle East and Africa. They're not the people that make it to Europe or Australia, and certainly not to the U.S., the trickle of people that actually make it here. It's just a shame that it takes this movement into Western developed countries to suddenly say there's a crisis, where there's been a crisis for a long time throughout Africa and throughout the Middle East. So it's, again, how we're positioning these things. Right now we're talking about, UNHCR talks about 21 million displaced people, and 70% of those just in Africa and the Middle East. You know, not only do we have to think of which crisis are we talking about, because let's face it, all of these different meanings, as I say, are pointing about a common phenomena, but sort of feeling around the same elephant and coming up with different descriptions of what's going on. Even just talking about crisis as this blip, as this emergency, puts on blinkers to thinking, well, it's something that has just happened and it's going to be over, rather than helping us imagine that this is something systematic and long-term. We can't just see migration in terms of single causes. Either you're fleeing a civil war or you're looking to go get a better job someplace. The causes of migration are multiple. People's environments, especially in Africa, are being totally degraded. That has knock-on effects for the economy. That has knock-on effects for politics, which often leads to further human rights abuses of people and further violence within a lot of these societies. And so people just have to get out. You know, colleagues of mine talk about survival migration. So many social, economic, and political conditions are just unlivable. And so people leave that. But you see, when they start to get to Europe, they're not really counted as refugees because, well, if it's a combination of factors, your environment is screwed, your economy is awful, your politics are, you know, a disaster, you're living in a failed state, we don't really want to take you either on humanitarian grounds or on refugee grounds because the definition doesn't fit. But it's those conditions that are the long-term sustainable things. And just talking about crisis as something happening now that will be over soon keeps us from seeing these long-term systematic global problems that are the real thing that we have to focus on, I'd say.
So I've been delighted to come here to the Conference on World Affairs and speak about a whole lot of things in Australia that I'm really proud of. I spoke about how we achieved gun control reform in the 1990s. Tomorrow I'm speaking about how we have a compulsory system of voting and how that's affected our political system. And there are many things that I'm really proud of to speak of as an Australian. But what I'm going to talk to you about today is something that I'm deeply ashamed of to speak of as an Australian. Australia generally has a reputation as being a very liberal, multicultural, welcoming country. And what I'm going to explain to you that in fact the weeping sore on Australia is the way in which we treat refugees. So Australia's refugee policy, and in particular, and I'll explain the specifics of it in a moment, but in particular, the policy whereby those refugees who try to reach Australia by boat are placed in detention camps offshore on South Pacific Islands, and I'm talking about men, women, and children here, has attracted international condemnation. The Human Rights Committee, who polices the ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, has had a number of cases brought before it by asylum seekers who were subject to detention, and each time it's found against the Australian government for breaching that international covenant. The UN Special Rapporteur on Migration described the conditions in which these asylum seekers are kept as cruel, inhuman, and degrading. When the refugee crisis really started in Europe. It just so happened that our Prime Minister, Tony Abbott at the time, was in the UK, and he started speaking about the Australian refugee policy as a way in which the refugee crisis in Europe could be dealt with. And I think a real indicator of how bad our policies are, Nigel Farage, who is the leader of UKIP, the far-right nationalistic anti-immigration party in the UK that really led the Brexit campaign, his response to Abbott's sort of insistence that Australia's policy is the way to go was, not even the UK could stomach Australia's immigration policies. Now, of course, you also know that one of the first, the first phone call between President Trump and our Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull, soured on the basis of a deal that Turnbull had made with the Obama administration regarding the United States taking these people who are languishing in these detention centres. Trump apparently called the deal the worst deal ever and hung up on our Prime Minister. Now, maybe it is a really bad deal for America, taking, it's about 1,500 asylum seekers who are languishing in these camps in a South Pacific Island nation called Nauru and an island off Papua New Guinea. But as humans, it could be a really good deal for these people, right? The politics in Australia around this particular group of refugees is so toxic. And there are so many people in Australia who've been working to try to get the Australian government to take these people back to Australia and give them a life there. The refusal on both sides of politics has been unanimous. And so I sort of am pleading with you that even though it might not be a great deal for American interests, it's 1,500 people and they are literally dying and getting sicker and sicker. The pictures that these children are drawing that we see in the media just breaks your heart. These are young children who have no prospect. They can't see a future other than in a detention centre. I knew that I was going to... I'll pull back now and explain to you a little bit more about what the policy is in Australia and how we got there. Like, why is it that it's so toxic in Australia that we can't accept 1,500 refugees into our country? So generally speaking, Australia today has a sort of a moderate or a reasonable immigration policy, with the exception of those asylum seekers who arrive on our shores by boat. We call these, under our legislation, irregular maritime arrivals. When the policy was implemented in the 2000s, the Migration Act actually referred to them as illegal maritime arrivals. But they weren't illegal, because seeking asylum is not illegal, but the legislation referred to them as illegal maritime arrivals. We now refer to them as irregular maritime arrivals, which is, I think, only slightly better. And they usually set off from Indonesia, although they're not Indonesian. The majority of them are fleeing persecution and war in the Middle East, or civil war in Sri Lanka, or they're persecuted Rohingya Muslims from Myanmar. That's the general groupings of the people who are coming to Australia. So there's two planks to our policy on this. The first is turnbacks. Okay, so these people are usually overladen on very unsuitable fishing vessels from Indonesia, and our Navy is instructed to turn them around and send them back to Indonesia. And this results in sometimes sabotage of the boats, because the asylum seekers obviously do not want to be turned back to Indonesia. They've risked a lot to try to get to Australia. That can and has led to deaths at sea. So we have our Navy personnel literally fishing bodies out of the water because of the turnback policy. The second plank of the policy is anyone who does arrive in Australia by boat is dealt with in a special part of our Migration Act, and they will not be processed in Australia. They'll be sent to an offshore detention camp, and this is the offshore detention aspect of it, either on Nauru or on Manus Island in Papua New Guinea. Both of these countries agreed to the Australian government's request to establish detention centres. Both of them receive an enormous amount of foreign aid from Australia, and we're really not in a position to say no. The actual offshore detention centres are not run by the Nauruan or the Papua New Guinea government. They're not run by the Australian government. No one wants to get their hands dirty. They're run by private contractors. And I should also note that Australia has managed to implement all of this while still staying a signatory to the International Refugee Convention. I don't know how it's managed to maintain that dissonance. So why? Why do we have this really inhumane refugee policy in Australia for boat arrivals? Well, our politicians would like us to believe there is a crisis, or there would be a crisis if they didn't have such severe policies. But no, there's not a crisis and there never has been a crisis. The most people who came to Australia in any one given years was 20,000 people who arrived in 2013. And otherwise it's been between 500 and about sort of 2,000-3,000 people a year. Okay, just contrast that to the 1.2 million in 15 months that Stephen was talking about a moment ago in Germany. We are not being swamped by boat people. So why? Refugees have become political tools, political pawns in Australia. And really it goes back to the 2001 election, federal election, when John Howard, who was our Prime Minister at the time, looked like he was facing defeat at that election. And then what happened was a boat of asylum seekers came, their boat deteriorated, the fishing vessel they were in, and they were picked up by a Norwegian tanker called the MV Tampa. Under international law, the Tampa was obliged to pick these asylum seekers up and take them to the nearest port. So they started heading for Australia. The Australian Prime Minister refused the Tampa to dock at Christmas Island, the Australian port, and then sent 45 SAS troops onto a Norwegian vessel to prevent the vessel from docking in Australia. And the Australian public loved it. He snatched victory from the jaws of defeat at the 2001 election. And really from that moment on, we've had bipartisan support for policies like this in relation to people trying to arrive by boat. But why is it a successful political tool in Australia? Aren't we sort of liberal-minded, multicultural, fair-go-mate kind of people? Well, no. In 1901, when we became a federation, when Australia was created, it wasn't the first piece of legislation, that's a bit of a myth, but it was in the first tranche of legislation that was passed was the Immigration Restriction Act, which gave effect to the White Australia policy. That was the policy of our framers, of our constitution. What the Immigration Restriction Act contained was a power for any migration official to require a dictation test for any person seeking to come to Australia. And what they would do is they would choose a European language, which is what they were allowed to choose under the legislation, that might have been so obscure if they decided that a particular person was not of the race that they wanted to come to Australia. And so the dictation test in the Immigration Restriction Act for 60 years was used to restrict non-white immigration to Australia. Our constitution was a racist constitution and remains a racist constitution. Well, we don't have a Bill of Rights that would protect equality and equal treatment. It's worse than that. We actually have a provision in our constitution that allows the parliament to pass racist laws. And our framers wanted that in there because they wanted the parliament to be able to restrict the employment of non-white races, the movement of non-white races in Australia. And that's because we were small colonies, a very long way away from the United Kingdom, and we feared this idea of being swamped by those races who were closest, the South Pacific and Asia. Okay, so we were built on a racist constitution. We had a White Australia policy. There were a couple of decades of enlightenment. We disestablished the White Australia policy in the late 60s, and we had a number of prime ministers who showed enormous leadership, Gough Whitlam and Malcolm Fraser in particular, and they started welcoming migrants and refugees, particularly during the Vietnam War, and Vietnamese refugees were coming by boat to Australia. And they proved that good political leadership could overcome the foundations of the Australian nation. But then in 2000, what John Howard proved is that they still remained there somewhere. And that's what the prime ministers from John Howard onwards have been tapping into.
So Sweden on a per capita basis has taken in more refugees than Germany even. 2015, they took in 160,000 refugees, and they have a population of 9 million. And I think they only stopped because they ran out of housing and they started putting people in tents in southern Sweden. And even though it's southern Sweden, it was December, that was finally, it seemed to me, like when the Swedish government said, maybe we need to stop taking refugees because we have nowhere to put them. What shocked me last visit was, well, the morning I wake up, my first morning there, I read in the newspaper about these hooligans running through the train stations attacking the immigrants. They're actually usually Roma people asking for money in the train station. They're not the asylum seekers. They're actually Europeans. They're allowed to be there. Later that day, we were downtown going to a museum, and we run into all these police barricades and so forth, and there's a nationalist rally. So there's been a boom in the popularity of this nationalist anti-immigrant party in Sweden, and they were having a rally. So it was very strange for me, because when I left Sweden in the 1970s, we didn't even fly the flag because it was the height of socialism. It was ugly to sing the national anthem. Well, I think it has to do with the history, really, of Europe, of 20th century Europe and fascism, I guess. But, of course, here in the U.S., we fly the flag and sing the national anthem all the time. But anyway, so I'm trying to set the scene, like how odd it was for me to run into this rally where they're flying the flag and singing the national anthem. And honestly, I can tell you, I think they didn't know all the words because they were faltering. They were totally faltering. But anyway, so big changes in Sweden. I mean, when I left, our immigrants there were the Finns. They were our Mexicans. They were. So let me talk a little bit about professionally how I came back into this topic, because actually a couple years ago, a Swedish think tank asked me and my co-author to write a paper on the economic impact of immigration. And so we started looking at the question in Sweden, and we sort of take the same framework, analytical framework that we apply to immigrants in the U.S., and we're trying to apply it to the European scenario. And people really haven't looked at immigration the way we look at it. I mean, it's sort of, we have a very dispassionate way. Okay, here are the economic benefits. Here are the economic costs. Here are the fiscal costs, and here are the fiscal benefits. You know, and so we kind of reduce the immigrant down into a number. And I think there's a reason Europeans have resisted that, because if they did that, the immigration to Europe, because the way in which they treat their immigrants, it's going to be a net cost, I think. And in Europe, there's been a lot of regulations around who can work, who cannot work. And I think usually the first year or two when you come into as an immigrant into the European Union, you can't work. That's a big minus for the immigrant, because if he can't or she can't work, then they can't contribute economically or fiscally, for that matter, in terms of taxes. The other thing that we found was shocking was how poorly immigration, and especially these large increase in the inflows, was handled at the EU level. Like, can you handle anything in a worse manner? You have to file for asylum in the first country in which you step into, which means that all the asylums, all the weight, all the burden of the refugee inflow was on Italy and Spain and Greece in particular. And then there didn't seem to be any offsetting funds flowing from the European Union to these countries to help them with this huge influx. What were they supposed to do? You know, over 1 million asylum seekers in the space of a year or two. Then there's no European border patrol. There's no European, really, police structure around this European Union, and no resources for these peripheral countries, which are the poorest countries in sort of Western Europe, right? One amazing example, a shocking example, was for a couple years, even before this latest, you know, influx, the Italians, when there started to be more and more migrants dying on the Mediterranean with their ships sinking and, you know, thousands were dying, the Italians came up with an idea, we're going to send out these boats and we're going to rescue these migrants. And they did this for a couple of years and they saved thousands of lives. But nobody would offset the cost and it became too costly. And the European Union didn't help. So they abandoned this. And so, you know, we're back to scenario which it was pre this effort, which was basically when those boats sink, that basically the people die. The lack of coordination and the willingness of each nation to push the crisis onto other nations. And I think that's how sort of Germany and Sweden ended up with bearing a bulk of the burden.
This is a very hard topic. It's too much conflict, too much crisis, and we need to take action. This is not a silly point of view. In literature, we are so awareness about how symbol change, cultural tradition change. The sea is not the sea that we appreciate during the Romanticism. The sea is not this peaceful place anymore. When I think in that image, I like to think in a we, not in the immigrant or the refugees. They are refugees. No, I am thinking about we and how this war doesn't mean the same anymore for anybody. I am an immigrant, and in some ways, I moved from my country, Colombia, because of some reasons that have to be with life. You have to preserve your life, first of all. I was not a guerrilla or something like that. I only want to help people that was fed from the rural communities because of the violence and the civil war in my country that more than 50 years. Still, we have a problem. We have not solved a complete problem. But I am not thinking only that why I was in dangerous, because I was helping communities, and there were paramilitary, there were guerrilla, there were different point of views, and nobody knows if I was guerrilla or not. If I was walking and talking to someone, maybe the paramilitaries and the government took me, kidnapped me, because they think that I am a guerrilla. Surgeon. This is the first step why, in some points, I left my country. I had a good life over there. The second point was really, really the reason why I left my country. It was too much death around. Every day the news, on one hand, about famous celebrities, and the other hand was about a lot of people dead, hundreds of people found dead in holes. And then when we are exposed as citizens of the country to this level of violence, it doesn't matter if I live in a beautiful neighborhood, I work in a beautiful university, I receive well payment, then it is very, very dangerous that my mind accustomed to the violence. And it happened. It was happening to me. I remember I was driving, and then it was an accident, a car accident in my country. And I said, oh, my God, oh, thanks God, there are only 5 people dead. And I was talking to someone that was accompanying me, and he said, Sofia, what are you saying? And I was answering, okay, the truth, but in what way? And then, this is true, we talk about violence, refugees, as they are over there. And we have to do something, like throw something to help them. But there are a lot of implication, emotional, psychological, cultural implication of the refugees. One image, one, has to be with the guardian angel. Since I was presenting my book, one of my book, and it is about my history, but in literature. Why this image is very important for me is because it was the image that, being a kid, I felt very safe with this kind of symbol. And I still keep this for my culture. I don't care if it is truth or not, but it's a value for me, a good one. This kind of figure support me, give me peace, help me, and give me hope that it is very important and a kind of very strong attitude to continue with my life. Literature has to be with crisis, have to be with real life, have to be with the life that we see as a fiction because we have an automatic routine. Literature helps us to think, to have a reflection about ourselves and the human being. What called my attention when I studied Greek literature were the tragedies and the cycle of revenge, war, violence, resentment. And it is a cycle. It doesn't stop. And I remember King Oedipus, the tragedy of the man, the wisest man in the kingdom. He knows everything, about whatever you can ask. But his tragedy was that he didn't know anything about himself. then how this tragedy teach me to know myself and to include myself in the world, not with a label, not with the label of Latina or immigrant or speaker. The second tragedy that motivated my interest in literature was the one that has to be with Shakespeare, that is provide a statement. If you don't know your own story and your own history, you are condemned to repeat that. With these two statements, I like to put together a word that is very important to continue with a movement. We are all immigrants. Maybe you remember how your family, your grandmother, your grandfather arrived to this country. What kind of conflict brought them to this country? What initiated this conflict? The police is the place in which citizens can have a very good will life and to provide to the police the same kind of level of life that they receive. And what brings people to this conflict? The protest, the right to march, the right to ask for human dignity and human equality and human right. Then I only like to put you in the present with me and realize that this conflict is not a conflict that we see so far from us, but is touching us and is here with us. And it's a global one. It's a global crisis. And we have to solve globally, one by one, the crisis. In small communities and in the Washington community, international community.
Gabriela, I mean, as a lawyer, are these, you know, pretty atrocious policies being, you know, challenged in courts, whether Australian courts or international human rights courts and so forth?
Absolutely. There is an entire sort of a growth of organisations that have developed to try to assist these asylum seekers. The Refugee Advocacy Service, the Human Rights Law Centre take a lot of these cases on. Where do they go? They go wherever they can. As I said, the Human Rights Committee, which is, oversees the ICCPR, there have been applications made on behalf of individuals in detention to that committee. That committee can only make findings. And the response of our government has been that it's nice that that's the committee's view, but it's not Australia's view, that it's cruel, inhuman and degrading treatment. So the international condemnation has been ignored. They've tried challenges in the Australian courts, and really because our courts don't have the tools that they need to deconstruct these types of policies. Our constitution doesn't have the protections for individuals, and indeed our High Court has interpreted the constitution that those little protections that are there don't apply equally to what the constitution refers to as aliens, and so that they're not able to get even the small protections that are in our constitution. So they have failed. Where there has been success is a number of asylum seekers who are being held in the Manus Island Detention Centre in Papua New Guinea challenged that detention in the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court. And the Papua New Guinea Constitution has a Bill of Rights, a constitutional Bill of Rights, and that detention centre was held to be unconstitutional. And the Papua New Guinea Supreme Court ordered the Papua New Guinea government to decommission the detention centre as soon as possible. That was 18 months ago, 2 years ago. The Manus Island Detention Centre still operates. What they did is they technically opened the doors, and so they're no longer technically in detention. But of course, Papua New Guinea is a very difficult place. And it's a very homogenous society in terms of there are not many immigrants who live in Papua New Guinea, and there is also a lot of discontent with the detention centre, and there has been a number of incidences of violence, and in fact the deaths I was referring to was where Papua New Guinea guards beat an asylum seeker to death. So you can imagine if you're an asylum seeker in Manus Island, you've got a Papua New Guinea Supreme Court decision saying that you're free and you are desperately seeking asylum in the detention centre from the Papua New Guinea, the broader community at this stage. So yes, they have desperately been seeking review, and so far it has been unfruitful.
As a high school student, individual here in the States, is there anything that they can do to help? What can they do and how would they do it?
Well, you know, obviously high school students, I'm sure these days, as when I was, you don't have any money, so you can't donate anything. But if you're interested, learn as much as you can, gather information, and find ways of sharing that information. That's the best thing, raising public awareness of the kinds of issues that we've all been talking about, amongst each other, amongst your parents, amongst your city community, and so forth. Whether you do that individually or organize groups, there's plenty of organizations, Amnesty International and so forth, that would love to have more and more young people involved. There's plenty of stuff to do. And I would say first, in terms of raising public awareness.
I would say the same thing. And I'm not sure what programs exist in the United States, but there are a number of programs in Australia that I've been involved in when I was a university student, for example. You can become involved with other peoples. Teaching English to refugees, for example, is one thing that I did once a week. Young people's voices are actually really powerful in this debate. Because I think if you can stand up and give these people humanity and start using the word we, just as Sophia was sort of urging us to start talking about we are all humans and we should be able to understand the plight of others in that way. If you can start speaking that type of language, that is going to be heard really powerfully, I think, at the political level, because this is, at least from my country and from what I've seen over in the United States, a really big political issue that education and voice is so important about.
I just wanted to add quickly, we just had an influx of Syrian refugees into Dallas and some of them into my daughter's middle school. And so what some of the kids are doing is helping the newly arrived immigrant children, these children who don't speak English, helping them with English, volunteering to help with homework. I think just showing them kindness, willingness to show them, you know, where's your class, you know, this is how the system works here, this is, you know, just teaching them about American culture. The other thing that we've done is churches in our community are helping resettle some of these Syrian and Iraqi families, actually. And so we've been helping them. Donating clothes is something that you can do as students. And also if these immigrants, for example, are going to class or English classes, so you can offer to babysit smaller children as well. And I think all those are things you can do.
The perspective of inclusion, don't see people different from you that others, like rape people, but include them, embrace them, and etc. Maybe you have you can have extracurricular activities in which you can learn about these societies and try to understand them more. And also, it's so great. I like to create a class, for example, about kindness studies, how we can increase the love for others.
Following on what Sophia has just mentioned, the idea of being the other, for Stephen and Pia, this question is, what are Germany and Sweden doing to assimilate the large number of refugees? And with that question, to frame it, was another one saying, is it fair culturally for these countries, specifically Germany and Sweden, but other countries as well, to accept only refugees who seem able to assimilate?
These countries are very organized in how they're going to assimilate immigrants. And I like to compare them to the U.S., where there's like no organization around this whatsoever. We just throw you into the labor market, go work for someone. We know you don't speak the language, but it doesn't matter. You know, within 3 months, you should be independent, basically. That's what we tell our refugees that we bring in. So in Sweden, and I think in Germany, it's similar probably, you have to take Swedish classes. They really accommodate you very generously with housing allowance and allowance for living expenses. these classes. If you have kids, they give you car seats for the children. There's a lot of help and a big infrastructure around assisting refugees that come to Sweden. The problem has been in Sweden, the trickiest cases are not the families, but the young men that come on their own. And so, they are sometimes, not even adults. They might be 17-year-olds or 16-year-olds, and sometimes they're young adults. But what do you do with these guys? It's been a real big problem. They're putting them into some kind of, youth homes. But invariably, a lot of young, restless men that are not integrated, don't speak the language, put them all together in one place. Oh, you can just imagine. So there's been a lot of problems around these youth homes. There's been violence. There was a recent case where the woman that was in charge of this one of these homes, they actually killed her because she was trying to enforce the rules. And so it's not easy, but they do have a well-developed infrastructure around trying to address this.
We could be here all afternoon for me to go through what all the things Germany has done just over the past year and a half. Absolutely astounding logistical operation, first to start with. I mean, 1.2 million people arriving in a course of months, distributed throughout the country. And, well, let's face it, I'd say only Germany could have done some of the things they've done due to incredible efficient systems, multiple levels of government working together, and lots of money. Germany has a budget surplus. They're in the black. They could afford it. And so, just first of all, setting up a massive nationwide infrastructure, going down, right to village levels and so forth, providing instantly housing, sustenance, setting up language courses, setting up childcare, setting up legal services, setting up social services, health services. Absolutely astounding. 1 million people overnight, and literally overnight. I mean, I was working with the mayor in the town where I'm based, and he was saying that every day he would get a call. Tomorrow you're getting 330 people. The next day, you're getting 275 people. The next day, you're getting 145 people. The next day, you're getting 350 people. And he had to deal with that, no question. He couldn't opt out. But they had the resources and the will, and one of the main things, tens and tens of thousands of Germans themselves volunteered in all the sorts of ways you said, taking care of people, showing them around, taking them in, helping them with their language. My daughter herself taught language. And the amazing thing is, there have been incidents of violence, a bit of ugliness and so forth, but, you're talking about an influx of people the size of the city of Munich. And if you're not going to have a few incidents of crime and so forth, I'm not downplaying them at all. Awful. We don't want them. But in a population that scale, the main news is how peaceful it's all been, how well people have adopted, taking on jobs, living in communities, people welcoming them. And since late 2015, when the influx occurred, German public opinion about the refugee crisis and immigrants has gotten more positive. It was already in a positive way, and it's gotten better, remarkably, despite these things. And so I think, that is the miracle. That's the thing I'd like to put my finger on, is that, ugly incidents occur, and basically more incidents occur against refugees than for refugees. The number of refugees' homes set on fire and so forth have occurred. And again, I can go long about this. It's a whole history of East versus West Germany. All of the incidents happen in East Germany for a whole host of reasons. Basically, the fact that in West Germany, they've had a history of most German states have up to 20% people with migration background. In East Germany, most of those states have had no more than 5% of people with migration background. So they have not been able to deal with difference in the same way as West Germans have.
Why are so many refugees coming to Germany and Sweden? And you both addressed that somewhat. I don't know if there's a few more specifics you can tell some of the students who don't understand how the social welfare system might function differently in terms of money and, things you need to live that are provided. Maybe you could just share a few words.
Well, let me just go in there, because I don't think you were suggesting this, Tamar, but certainly in a lot of public understanding of migration flows, a lot of people think, they want to go to places where they can get a free handout better. And no, people who are fleeing violence and so forth go where they can. They don't even know what conditions are facing them. These people don't know what country they're going to end up in. You know, especially with the Dublin regulations, what you were talking about, where people were supposed to apply for asylum in the first place, that was thrown out the window. And so, yes, some people know they want to get to Sweden or Germany because they've already got a relative there. Or through their social networks. I mean, all these people have smartphones and so forth, and they know a bit, but they're not searching for the best handout or something. And it just happened to be places like Germany and Sweden that were most open for this. And, you know, one of the big questions, it might even be in your pile there, is why did Angela Merkel say we're going to take in 1 million people and more? And, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, and the historians are going to be picking over this forever, and, you know, right now there's a lot of input. And, you know, some people, I think, rather crudely say, well, you know, Germany is facing, it's an aging society and they need more workers. It was just a way to get more workers. Well, yeah, they are going to benefit from a lot more workers if people get their actual, you know, asylum status verified. But I think that's too cruel. A lot of indications seem that it was an emotional response by Angela Merkel, that, you know, she was deciding what to do, and there was some violence early on in the influx in 2015 in an East German city where there had been some ugly incidents, people beaten up, refugee homes set on fire. Merkel went there herself, and the story goes that she was in a car and just on her way out, and people shouting at her, and some woman came up to the window and called her a traitor and a C-word. And she was astounded by that and said, all right, well, you know, we need to do something different than that sentiment and open things up. And I'm of the same opinion as been voiced by Emmanuel Macron, who's running for president in France. And he said, you know, Frau Merkel, you have saved our dignity.
Climate change, and that's affecting refugees. I don't know if there's a specific example or two that might help make it more clear for folks in the audience. Those are from students.
I can give an example from the region in which I'm from. Particularly down in the South Pacific, there are a number of smaller nations that are really concerned about rising sea levels, and it's not going to take much more for them to lose entire towns and villages because of the rising sea levels. And so as a precautionary approach, they're already engaging in negotiations with countries about where they may go to seek refuge, perhaps not if, but when this is going to happen. What we've seen in Australia very consistently with our policies is that New Zealand has entered into agreements with Kiribati, for example, that they will take climate change refugees. And we're talking very small numbers here. These are small nations. Australia has refused to enter into those negotiations.
No, migration rarely, if ever, has a single cause. I mean, we hear about a new category, environmental refugees and so forth, but it's, as I was saying, it's not simply just about the environment. You know, with climate change, the environment in across large parts, particularly Africa, but also Middle East, is degrading rapidly. But like I say, it isn't just about not being able to grow crops. That affects the whole economy. That affects the politics. A lot of people don't know, in Syria, before the civil war, Syria had a 10-year drought, which pushed a lot of people into cities, which created a lot more political tension, and it wasn't the factor, but it was certainly a contributory factor to the breakout of the civil war as well. You see how it's economic, political, and environmental wrapped together, and that's the nature of a lot of migration causes today.
I think we have immigration policy around a lot of issues, but we don't have one around climate change in particular. So that's interesting. But then I was thinking, so what have we used in the past when, you know, other countries have faced these problems? And so we do have something called temporary protective status, which is TPS, which is something that we use. So thinking of examples like there were hurricanes in Central America, which caused a lot of, displaced a lot of people, earthquake in Haiti, although that's not climate change. But again, something that affects, something in nature that affects people. And so we do have this TPS policy in the United States that can address these things, at least temporarily. But probably that would be a good area to develop policy specifically for climate change.